Thank you all for coming this morning. I'm Sherry Schrager in the Division of Adolescent Medicine at Children's Hospital Los Angeles. Carolyn and I work together on this project. These slides are almost as new to me as they are to you, so I'm going to do my best with it. And if I make a hash of it or run over time, grab the cane and yank me off. Carolyn has nothing to disclose, which is why I'm here. No, I have nothing to disclose either. Okay. Minority stress. As Gabriel was so kind to mention, minority stress is our theoretical background for this project. The general idea of this is that minorities experience poor health outcomes, not as any necessary direct result of their own behavior, but because of the stressors that they experience as minority members. And this incorporates both what we call distal stressors, or the external community type of stressors, like experiences of racism, homophobia, these external things that are done to the individual, as well as proximal stressors, which are stressors that are happening within the individual, things like internalized racism or internalized homophobia, where the society is creating this within the person. This is a particular interest and concern for African-American young MSM because they are, in a sense, dual minorities. They're both racial minorities in the society as well as sexual minorities, and so they sort of get a double dose of these stressors with pretty astounding implications for both health and risk-taking behaviors that they might engage in to deal with these stressors. It is no surprise, I think, to anybody in this room that African-American young men who have sex with men are still among the most at risk for HIV compared to other populations. One way that they may potentially deal with these stressors is to form communities among themselves, because they may be at risk for rejection from the broader African-American community or at risk for rejection from the broader gay community. So they have started to incorporate among themselves communities such as the House and Ball communities. These communities date back to the early 1900s. These days, they consist primarily of African-American and Latino or Latina individuals. One hallmark of the communities is that they are welcoming of many different types of gender and sexual expressions and identities. Originally, it was formed in response to external stressors, such as economic and social exclusion. These days, it seems to be more of a celebratory focus on recognizing the individual and their talents. So house and ball communities are comprised of both houses and balls. Houses are a sort of family-type structure. There's generally a house mother and house father that are not necessarily tied to any individual's expressed gender. You can have house mothers or fathers who are male or female or none of the above, anywhere in between. But they're fictive families that provide a social network and social support structure for the members of the houses. Generally, what they do is organize balls, which are the events that I'll tell you about shortly, but they provide a localized sense of support, and sometimes this can be material support, money to attend the events, certain resources that they may need, but it may also be social, more intangible types of support for the house members, which are referred to as their children. Balls are social events or parties that tend to be put on by the houses. Depending on where you are, they're all over the country. We're studying the Los Angeles house and ball scene for this talk, but there's an organization in Oakland, in New York, Atlanta. They're all over. And they generally have some number of balls per year. It can range from, you know, 3 up to, I think some of them are having like 10 to 15 a year, depending on how active the organization is that year. And it's an opportunity for the members of the community to come together and, you know, have a party, have a fun social event, but there's also intense competitions that go on at the ball events that feature dancing and performance, face, dress, and it has some of it has to do with gender performance, some of it has to do with more athletic types of performance, but they're very exciting events, and it's a chance for people in these communities to express themselves and really take pride and take joy in who they are and displaying that in a safe environment for them. House and ball communities are really identity-affirming in that way and offer sources of emotional and instrumental support that are not necessarily available through other venues or other social connections that these young men may have. House parents, in particular, may play an important role both as acting as a role model and setting norms for the men in their houses and also offering guidance and support in that way. The balls are a chance to recognize different members both individually and collectively as parts of houses for their self-expression and for their talents. So the current study is focusing on, as I mentioned, members of the house and ball community in Los Angeles. This is a potentially large risk vector as far as HIV transmission goes. Drug use has also been previously associated with these communities, but it's a very tight, hidden network, and we've had the opportunity to study it fairly extensively, which is pretty extraordinary. And for the purposes of this talk, what we're focusing on is trying to understand the experiences of minority stress for this doubly marginalized community, and to understand the roles of support and connection within this community, and how that relates to mental health outcomes. Our explicit hypothesis for this was that these communities would be providing support and connection opportunities that we hoped would buffer some of the minority stress experiences that these young people are facing. The parent study was a collaborative effort between our research team based at Children's Hospital Los Angeles and the House and Ball communities of the greater Los Angeles County area. Sampling procedures were modeled after our Healthy Young Men study, with similar venue selection and participant recruitment strategies. Basically, we sent a team out to every ball event that we possibly could and recruited young people on the scene. We were not discriminatory in terms of participation, even though these are generally African and American and Latino young men who have sex with men. We did not want to exclude anybody who didn't identify in that particular way. So we have a range of participants from the youngest, I believe, in our study was 17, all the way up to 53. Our sample did ultimately consist primarily of people who identified as men, but we did have some women-identified people as well. Our respondents completed a fairly short interview, 30 to 45 minutes, on site, and received a $40 incentive to compensate them for their time. The sample I'm talking about today is 233 self-identified males, and this is because we're particularly looking at gay identification among young men. We didn't want to confound that gay identification variable with any of the young women who were in the study. So we're selecting on gender just for this sample, but the larger sample does have women in it. So just from brief descriptive statistics of our sample, we got a fairly even range distribution. As I said, it ranged from 17 to 53, but the vast majority of our sample was between 17 and 26, primarily identified as Black or African American. We did have some Latino representation, but it's generally a minority sample. About 70% of our participants identified as gay or another term used to represent same-sex attraction. We had a quarter of them who identified as bisexual, so that was kind of nice to have that presence there. A few others who identified as straight or didn't know or didn't want to report their sexual identity. And attraction, as you'll see, despite largely being gay identified, nearly equal numbers were attracted to men only versus men and women. So that was pretty interesting. Okay, I'm going to take probably most of my time to actually talk you through this slide because this is both our model and our results. So what you'll see here is our application of minority stress model to our data. The sort of more oval-shaped parts of the model are our latent variables. So this is basically assuming that the boxes that they're pointing to, kind of on the left of each oval, those are the indicators that we actually measured in our survey. And the idea is that the latent variable represents some sort of underlying construct that is tying together all of the information carried by these individual indicator variables. So we have a latent variable of general stressors, and these are not necessarily minority-related stressors that may nonetheless be impacting these young people's lives. So these are things like recent financial difficulties, weapon carrying, feeling the need to do that to defend themselves, and involvement in physical fights at balls. And these, again, they may be associated with some of the minority stress processes that they experience, but they're not indicators themselves of minority stress. Those were associated positively with distal minority stressors. So again, this is the more community level or environmental type of stressors. We had measures of racism, homophobia, social sexual racism, police harassment, have you ever been harassed by the police because of your race or ethnicity, and whether they had been made fun of by friends or family, people who cared about them because of their sexuality. And so these five loaded well onto distal stress. distal stress in turn predicted internalized homophobia, which was our single indicator of proximal stress. It's really the only one that kind of popped out of our survey as being relevant to that. So we have general stressors predicting distal minority stressors, predicting internalized homophobia. Both distal stress and internalized homophobia, or proximal stress, were associated with poorer mental health outcomes, which we measured with the four-item CESD. This is a depression-type inventory. It's not, you know, we didn't have any clinical diagnostic teams there, so it's all self-report. But higher CESD scores generally represent more depressive symptoms, poorer mental health at the time. Additionally, the amount of emotional support that they received predicted was negatively associated with CESD, thankfully. And gay identification was positively associated with CESD, with depressive symptoms, again, likely because of these stress processes. In addition, we have our third latent variable down at the bottom, which is their connection to their social network. So we asked them a series. There was a whole section of the survey devoted to tapping their social network. And basically how this worked is we asked them to name people who were providers of emotional support, tangible support, who would lend you $50 if you needed it, that kind of thing, and who they went to balls with. And they were allowed to name up to five people who did those things in their lives. And then we asked them a series of questions about those people. And so we asked them, are they male or female or some other gender? Are they, what kind of race are they? Are they house members? What do you do with them? Do they provide you sexual health advice? Are they people you personally had sex with? A whole host of questions about their different possible interactions with these people, characterizing them. Are they family, friends, that kind of thing? And as far as our latent variable goes, we have this sort of connection variable that describes how tied in they are to these people in their network. So the indicators of this latent variable are the proportion who are house members. So this is a measure of how connected they are to the house communities, the number of them who that attended balls with the respondent, so again, how much socialization and social support are they bringing to the balls with them, the density of their social network, which is about the number of people within their network who know each other. It's a measure of the proportion who know each other to the total possible number of proportions there, and the frequency of communication, so how often, on average, do you talk to these people? More than once a week, etc. And so the neat thing that came out is there were actually two interactions. That's why the line's going up to the line and down to the line. And they look as follows. There was a significant interaction between distal stress and instrumental support. So essentially, this is exactly what we were hypothesizing. The black line represents high support, and the effect of stress goes from left to right. The effect of stress is much stronger on depression for those who had low support, the gray dashed line, compared to those who had high support. That stress effect increasing depression is attenuated for those who had high social support. We also had a two-way interaction between gay identity and social network connectedness. So essentially, that main effect of gay identity on depressive symptoms was only among those who were disconnected from their community. Those who experienced high connection did not have that negative effect of their identity on depression. So, in terms of our key findings, certainly we believe that these are consistent with minority stress theory and confirmed our hypothesis that these supports and connection to their communities can potentially buffer the effects associated with minority stressors, both distal and proximal stress. And this is, again, carried through those two interactions that I just described. We did have some limitations to this study. How sad. The chiefest one is really that we wish we had more time. We fought, Carolyn and I fought really, really hard to get more items onto the survey, and we won some of the battles. We lost far more of them than we won because there was, and there is a very, very real and fair concern that young men, especially young men who are showing up to participate at a really fun social event, do not want to be held captive for too long taking some researcher's survey. So we had to keep it to 30 to 40 minutes at most because they just didn't really want to be there more than that. And that meant we had a four-item measure of mental health, and that's our outcome. You know, we wish we could have captured so much more nuanced detail, and it couldn't happen in this format. We recognize that our findings pertain specifically to those members of the Los Angeles house and ball community. They may not generalize generalize to other communities that may look different in other cities, and they may not generalize to other types of young men who are not necessarily parts of these communities. And something to recognize that we learned as this was ongoing, these are very dynamic communities. House membership change daily. There's a lot of fluidity in there. And so what we've been able to capture over about a one-year period of time is really a snapshot and may not necessarily be reflective of those communities as they are today, let alone as they will be going on into the future. Our conclusions from the study are that these communities are a great place of great influence, particularly given the importance of the social connections that are fostered there. And research should find ways to not only to investigate the risks and protective factors associated with these communities, but potentially to capitalize on these social connections to inform prevention interventions. And in closing, I would very much like to thank our funding partners at NIDA for supporting this study. Ian Holloway, Alon Meyer, and Michelle Kipke are co-authors on this paper, the staff who contributed to data collection and interacting with these wonderful members. Of course, the members of our community advisory board and the house parents who contributed a lot of time and energy into this study, and really the entire House and Ball communities for sharing this important part of their lives with us. Thank you.